It's Tuesday, March 8, 2011. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The main news today is out of Washington, D.C., where Representative Peter King, a Republican of New York, is using his role as chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee to convene hearings on what he has termed, quote, Al-Qaeda's coordinated radicalization and recruitment of people within the American Muslim community, end quote. These hearings are creating a good deal of controversy in Washington and beyond, with reverberations throughout even the Middle East and the watching world. Now, what Chairman King intends to do with this committee hearing process is to air a particular investigation having to do with how American Muslims are being targeted and then mobilized for Islamic terrorism, the radicalization of at least some very strategic and now well-known American Muslims by the group such as Al-Qaeda, indicates that something is going on here that obviously has a direct impact upon Homeland Security, the assignment of the House Homeland Security Committee. But the controversy has to do with the fact that this congressional committee is intentionally undertaking a study of one particular religious group in terms of its radicalization. Now, Representative King, the chairman of this committee, says that the investigation of American Muslims in this regard just makes sense. He said this, quote, the threat is coming from the Muslim community. The radicalization attempts are directed at the Muslim community. Why should I investigate other communities? End quote. President Obama, through a spokesman, made quite a statement on Sunday saying that Muslims are not America's enemies and that America would not undertake a witch hunt against Muslims. There are others who are complaining. Faisal Abdul Rauf, the man who is the imam, who is the co-founder of the project to develop a mosque near Ground Zero, he, along with Rabbi Mark Schneier, who is the president of the Foundation for Ethnic Understanding, said, quote, to single out Muslim Americans as the source of homegrown terrorism and not examine all forms of violence motivated by extremist belief, that, my friends, is an injustice, end quote. Those were the direct words of Rabbi Schneier, whose point was that this is, after all, an unwarranted targeting of one specific religious group. Now, let's look at this controversy for just a moment, because it is likely to expand. Let's ask the factual question first. Is there a particular mobilization of at least some American Muslims by Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups? The answer to that has to be yes. Just a consideration of recent events and terror strikes indicates the propensity of a growing number of homegrown American Muslims to undertake terroristic acts against the United States and our allies. What's the other side of this argument, then? Well, it's very clear. What we have here is not merely a minority, but a religious minority. And there must be extreme care and circumspection when the United States government or any of its various agencies is undertaking a consideration, much less an investigation, of a specific religious group. We need to remember that something is vitally at stake here. As a matter of fact, more than one reality and value is vitally at stake here. Of course, American Homeland Security is a matter of paramount public interest, and legitimately so. And what we must avoid here is the political correctness that refuses to name the problem for what it is. This Islamic terrorism is indeed, after all, Islamic. Muslims are indeed the ones who are largely carrying out these terroristic attacks. There is a worldwide phenomenon of Muslim terrorism that has to do with the worldwide aspirations of Muslims. But of course, that does not mean, and we must be at great pains to state that we know it does not mean, that all American Muslims, or even a large majority of American Muslims, are involved in any such activity or the support thereof. Instead, what we're looking at, however, is a very sizable and strategic minority, sizable if not in number, then in impact. We need to get over the political correctness that refuses to speak the problem for what it is. And this means that Islam is indeed a part of the issue here, and of course it's a part of the problem, given its understanding of its aims in terms of the worldwide rule under Sharia law. We come to understand that there is a particular problem here, that the name for which can only be stated as Islam. On the other hand, given our commitment to religious freedom, given our understanding of the danger of the state intruding into religious affairs, there has to be an enormous nervousness here, even on the part of those who are willing to overcome political correctness and name the problem for what it is. Therefore, this needs to be done in public in a way that is open to public scrutiny, is after all limited by public concerns, and which always values constitutional principles. This very difficult balancing act of principles is not only a difficult thing to achieve in the present, it is almost surely a sign of things to come. The world has been watching the escalation of the crisis in Libya as Muammar Gaddafi appears absolutely adamant to hold on to power, whatever the cost. And in this case, the cost is very clearly a cost paid in blood by his own citizens. What we're watching is a despot, a tyrannical dictator who is turning its own military upon his own people. Now, there's a lot going on here, of course, but one of the things that certainly is marking the current hour is an escalation also in calls for the involvement of Western nations in general, and the United States in particular, in terms of intervention in Libya on the side of those who are being abused by, attacked by, and killed by the Gaddafi regime. Christopher Hitchens, of whom little has been heard of late, has entered this fray with an article at Slate.com in which he argues that an American reticence to enter into this debate and then to enter into this fight is a matter that, after all, is going to course in the American character and the American consciousness. He says this, "There's another consequence of our continuing passivity. I am sure I am not alone in feeling rather queasy about being forced to watch the fires in Tripoli and Benghazi as if I were an impotent spectator. Indifference of this kind to the lives of others can have a coarsening effect. It can lower one's threshold of sympathy. If protracted unduly, it might even become brutalizing." End quote. Now, there's a great deal of sense in that statement, and as much as my worldview differs radically from that of the adamant atheist Christopher Hitchens, I do understand what he warns of here in terms of the brutalizing and coarsening effect of watching as these events unfold. But of course, there's another side to this story, and that is that if we actually knew what was going on in the world in virtually every corner, there would be sufficient cause for American intervention on the basis of the very same principles. That is not an argument on its own for a failure to intervene, where certainly we ought to intervene, if that is the judgment. But it is a recognition that there are limits to any individual's power, to any nation's power, and in this case, to the American ability to be successful and not even to add to the trouble of intervening in a situation such as is now unfolding in Libya. It's a very difficult situation and one that cannot be dismissed as a simple moral, much less foreign policy problem. I landed today in Los Angeles, picked up the Los Angeles Times, and found a fascinating column by Andres Martinez there in that newspaper. It has to do with the fact that Gaddafi has an unlikely assortment of friends who have come to his defense in Central and Latin America. He writes this, "Leftist leaders in Latin America should be ashamed of embracing a tyrant like Libya's Muammar Gaddafi." Who are we talking about here? Well, Mr. Martinez gives us ample evidence. First, someone like Hugo Chavez. After all, what we're looking at here is a Venezuelan president who is arguing that, after all, Mr. Gaddafi should be solidified in power and should be recognized as the legitimate ruler. Now, Mr. Martinez is very helpful in pointing out that Hugo Chavez is, after all, well, the 2004 recipient of what? The Muammar Gaddafi International Prize for Human Rights. What about Fidel Castro? Fidel Castro is also supporting Muammar Gaddafi. He, by the way, was awarded the Gaddafi Prize in 1998. What about Daniel Ortega, the former strongman of Nicaragua? Well, he is supporting Muammar Gaddafi. By the way, he received the Gaddafi Prize in the year 2009. Speaking to a rally in Managua, even as the Libyan leader was unleashing foreign mercenaries against his own population, that from the report of Mr. Martinez, we learned that Manuel Ortega said this, quote, "I have transmitted to him the solidarity of the Nicaraguan people," end quote. Now, as Mr. Martinez said, this should be a matter of great shame for Central and for Latin America, but it is another reminder of something that we should always keep in mind. You remember the old adage, birds of a feather flock together. Well, it turns out that works not only for birds, but for tyrants. And in this case, for despots who are willing to spill their own citizens' blood in order to solidify their own despotic power. Writing in Newsweek magazine, Niall Ferguson, one of the very finest historians among us, writes of Men Without Women. The subtitle of his article is The Ominous Rise of Asia's Bachelor Generation. Now, I have written about, and we have talked about, the issue of gendercide, the tragic assault upon baby girls both prior to their birth and after their birth in much of Asia, and especially in the countries of China and India. Now, Niall Ferguson points to the future as well as to the past when he points out the figure that is given by economist Amartya Sen, that the number of missing women is at least 100 million. Now, he's able to quantify this in a way that is absolutely fascinating. In China, this means that there are now so many more young men than young women that there will be a surplus of 22 million young Chinese men between the ages of 20 to 39. Now, let's quantify that. Dr. Ferguson suggests that means 10 cities the size of Houston, Texas, populated exclusively by young males. Now, the historian here plays his part in explaining how a youth bulge, in particular a male youth bulge, led to expansionist and imperialist impulses in previous centuries. He writes, European imperial expansion after 1500 was the result of a male youth bulge. Japan's imperial expansion after 1914 was the result of a similar youth bulge. And now, as Mr. Ferguson writes, this has scary implications. As he goes on, he writes this, don't be surprised if in the next generation, this kind of phenomenon takes the form of macho militarism and even imperialism. His last words in this article are chilling. Lock up your daughters. Oh, this reminds us that social engineering, whatever its cause and wherever its location, leads to tremendous moral and personal injury. All you have to do is look at the totalitarian regimes with all of their central planning and human engineering in the 20th century to understand all the misery that was brought by these efforts at social engineering. There is no more heinous and tragic form of social engineering than China's one-child-only policy and the prejudice against women and young girls that leads to abortion and infanticide of female babies in much of the world, in particular in China and in India. There is no way, let us point out, to make up 100 million-plus missing women in time for these living young men to have brides. There is more here at stake than frustrated young men who will never be able to marry. It is the frustration of a divine purpose for humanity that has in this case been corrupted and denied. The costs of this, of course, are incalculable. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'm in California in order to speak at the 2011 Shepherds Conference. I hope to see many of you there. If you're hearing noise in the background, it's because California's famed valley winds are kicking up a storm tonight, and you may even hear it on The Briefing. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.